Thank you. It's good to be with you this evening. Can you hear me okay? Is the sound system working? All right, great. It's great, as Jim said, to see so many kids here this evening. Before I forget, because sometimes I do, I want to tell you now that you can see the space station fly overhead. If with the help of your parents, get on the website or do a search on the internet for space station sightings or something to that effect. And there are a couple of websites out there where you can go to the website, put in the website where on the planet you are, and then it'll look ahead in the next couple of weeks and see if there are sighting opportunities. And it's amazing to watch it fly over and to realize there are typically six people on board. We've had continuous human presence up there since the fall of 2000. And not many people aren't aware of that. Tonight what I'd like to do is give you maybe a little bit of an introduction into what it's like to go to space and the space environment. But mostly, most of the time I want to spend putting you in the seat, if you will, the virtual seat on board the space station, looking out the window and looking back on the planet that we call home, Earth, and then considering what we see through the lens of Scripture. So let's get right into the slides here. That's the view. That's the planet Earth. It is an amazing view, and even after being up there for 6 months straight, you never get tired of this view. To get there is hard. And oh, by the way, for the folks in the back, maybe we turn the lights down just a little bit so the screens are a little easier to see. I just need a little bit of reading light up here. That's all we need. I don't know if you can do that from back there. Let's go to the next slide in the meantime. To get there is hard. We get there nowadays only by with the help of the Russians on a Russian rocket. It's called a Soyuz rocket. That's it right here. It launches from Kazakhstan, halfway around the world. When you launch to go to orbit, it takes a little less than 9 minutes to get to orbit. So that's a lot of power to get you going 17,500 miles an hour. In a Soyuz spacecraft, you feel four times your weight as you go uphill, we like to say. And in that less than 9 minutes, you're going in orbit, 17,500 miles an hour, as I said, orbiting the Earth every 90 minutes. So once you get there, you're going 16 times around the Earth every day, 16 times a day. Next slide. Of course, more familiar to most of us is the space shuttle, which unfortunately was put into museums a couple years ago. The space shuttle was the workhorse initially designed to put up the space station. That was its intent. It was designed in the 70s. We started flying it in 1981. The space station, of course, didn't come to fruition, didn't get the support and the funding and all of that, the approval to go until the 90s. And we did that, of course, with the Russians as a major partner, in addition to the Canadians, the Japanese, and the European Space Agency. So it's very international, and we have astronauts and cosmonauts from all of those represented countries. The space shuttle flew 135 times total. About 40 of those missions, a little less than 40, 37, 38, were dedicated to the space station. The first element was launched in 1998, and as I mentioned a couple minutes ago, the first crew to the space station that stayed there. We call them expeditions to the space station, launched in the fall of 2000, and since then we've had continuous human presence. The space shuttle was an amazing machine. How many people, anybody in here see the launch, space shuttle launch in Florida? A few of you. It was a pretty humbling experience to go down there and see all that energy and to know that there was typically a crew of six or seven on board. And again, with the space shuttle, it took about 8.5 to 9 minutes to get to orbit, after which time you're going 17,500 miles an hour. Now, when the shuttle launched, next slide, it would take about 2 days to catch up to the space station, and we had a very precise way that we rendezvoused with the space station and then docked with it, going about 1 inch per second or so. Both vehicles, both the space station and the shuttle, travel in 17,500 miles an hour. So it really is rocket science. And in a few minutes, I'm going to talk about the order in God's universe that allows us to do that, to predict the mathematical equations, to do that, to fire the engines at just the precise, the, mo- the little thrusters that we have at just the precise moment and the precise direction for the precise duration to be able to do that. It's all a testimony to the order in God's creation. Next slide. So you get to the space station. Here it is. If you were to go there today and get inside it, it would have the volume of about a 5,000 square foot house. A crew of six nowadays, so the crew has grown as it has gotten bigger, and we've gotten the life support on board to support a crew of six. So it's pretty roomy inside. That's the pressurized volume. Of course, the space station is much bigger than just the pressurized volume. And to give you an idea, if you could lay that on the ground, it would almost cover two football fields, certainly more than one football field. So it's a huge complex. Like I said, it took almost 40 space shuttle flights to get the pieces up there, one piece at a time, and about an equivalent number of Russian launches, by the way, to both get the pieces up there as well as supply the material that we needed to build it. Next slide. If you get inside and look out the window, this is what it looks like. So you see the external components of the space station out the window, and then, of course, the beauty of the Earth below. Well, in this case, above. There is really no below or above there. It's all a matter of perspective. In fact, you can turn in any body orientation at any time and make any direction up. It's hard to fathom that, but you get used to that after a while. We could look like this or watch the Earth, and it would look like this for no more than 40 or 45 minutes. And then the next slide, it might look like this. So there's a night view. You can see now the Earth is on the bottom of the screen there. You can see the yellow arc there that covers the surface of the Earth. That is the atmosphere. And one of the things that surprises everybody is the relative thinness of the atmosphere relative to the diameter of the Earth. In the atmosphere, I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute or two, or a few minutes. It's also the life support system. It's a critical component of the God-designed life support system that we have here on Earth to uniquely sustain life. Next slide. You see views like this. It's got a low sun angle there reflecting off the waters of an ocean somewhere. I don't remember exactly where this is. With the varying cloud layers. They just give just an awesome view of beauty and just a unique view of this portion of God's creation we call home. Next slide. A moon set. You see some high clouds there casting shadows from the setting sun, which is behind us in this view. Next slide. There's a sunset. Again, a great view of the atmosphere, the thinness of the atmosphere, and the different layers of the atmosphere, starting out with the very brilliant oranges working all the way up through the blues and the yellows and perhaps whites at some time. And that's the setting sun, just at the moment of setting. Next slide. This is, of course, we can relate to this when we look at the moon, but here on the Earth's surface in this picture, we see the illuminated part of the Earth and the dark part of the Earth. And then next slide has perhaps a better view of it. This is what we call the terminator. The terminator is the line on the Earth that when we fly over, it separates the lit part of the Earth from the dark part of the Earth. Now, terminator is a technical term. The writer of Job called it something else. In Job 26, which you may be familiar with, is thought of to be the oldest book of the Bible. And I am going to go to several scriptures during this hour. And I encourage you, if you want to take notes of the scriptures I'm referencing and look at them, go back and look at them later. I think that you'll find that to be encouraging. Job 26, verse 7, he says, and this is Job speaking, he stretches out the north over the void and hangs the earth on nothing. I can tell you, having orbited the earth several thousand times, there are no strings attached. He does hang it on nothing. Later in verse 10, he says, he's talking about God. Job is talking about God. He says, he has inscribed a circle on the face of the waters at the boundary between light and darkness. So here we have in the oldest book of the Bible a very descriptive verse that tells us exactly what we're looking at that we can see from off the planet. And that gives testimony right to the scriptures, to the inspired word of God. That passage has fascinated me for years, since the first time that I went to orbit and then I came back and rediscovered it. At the end of that chapter, chapter 26, he writes, "Behold," he's speaking of the wonders of God's creation here that reflect the Creator behind the creation. But then he says, "These are but the outskirts of his ways. And how small a whisper do we hear from him?" In other words, this is just but it gives us a glimpse of God's creative work and who he is and everything about him. So let's look at a little bit more. We've seen a glimpse now. Let's look at a little bit more examples of the work of our Creator God. Here's a close-up of the layers of the atmosphere that you saw earlier. Next slide. These are called, I don't know if they show up real well. They show up a little bit. I guess there's a very unique texture in these clouds. We call them noctilucent clouds. They're higher than any clouds we typically see. They occur, or they're, at least they're seen. They may be there all the time, but they're seen typically in December over the South Pole and June over the North Pole, just with the sun on the other side of the horizon. So the sun is shining through the atmosphere. They have this very unique texture, and the next slide maybe shows up a little bit better in this room. There's a better view of this very fascinating, mysterious texture of what we call noctilucent clouds. I did a little research on the internet to see what the theories were out there on it. One of the theories I found several years ago was that some scientists said, well, these are caused by the exhaust from the space shuttle. And then you search a little bit more and you find that the first sighting, and they can be seen occasionally from the ground, first sighting was in the late 1800s, first recorded sighting. So he didn't quite do enough research, so we need to send him back to work. It's just an example of just the mystery that you can see in the details of the Earth and the systems around the Earth. Next slide. The Colorado River in the state of Utah, just upstream from the Grand Canyon. Next. The Grand Canyon itself. It's as amazing to look at up there as it is when you stand on the South Rim or the North Rim and view. In fact, if you go to how many have been to the Grand Canyon? Quite a few of you. If those that haven't, if you get a chance to go there, please go there. Because it's one example on the surface of the Earth that gives you a glimpse of what it's like to see the Earth from space. I mean, it's just awe-inspiring. Next slide. There's another one of the Grand Canyon. This one is right after a snowfall in late 2009 in a bleak angle. So we're looking at it sort of at an angle, not straight down. Next slide. Mount St. Helens. Spirit Lake is the silver white looking thing in the upper center part of the screen. You can see where half the mountain blew off in 1980. Very fascinating thing to look at, and I'm sure very fascinating on the surface as well. Next slide. Next slide. There's the Alps. We're looking to the northeast, so Germany would be in the upper part of the screen. France and Italy would be in the lower part of the screen, or below the screen, really. Next slide. Glaciers became one of my favorite things to photograph. This glacier is in the Pakistan, just because of its beauty and uniqueness, unique patterns. Next slide. Here's another one. This is in the southern end of South America in the Patagonia region. So you can see the very unique curvature of the glacier itself. You can see the texture of the glacier. And if any of you have been up to Alaska or elsewhere and maybe had a chance to fly over glaciers, you can see the turquoise blue in some of the ice. They look like giant crystals is what they look like. And you can see some of that texture in the upper part of the screen here. The icebergs in the water off to the right part of the screen. Next slide. This is an island called an atoll in the South Pacific, and my research tells me that there are several hundred people that live on this island. Some of them are descendants of one of Captain Cook's expeditions who got shipwrecked there, apparently. That's what I read. But it's a circular atoll with a lagoon in the center of the island. You can see the wave structure in the Pacific Ocean outside the the island showing up with the sun glint. Next slide. The Florida Keys, some of you have perhaps been there. Coral reefs became another one of my favorite things to photograph, again, because of the beauty and the splendor in color and pattern. Next slide. This is the Bahamas, not too far away from Florida. And the Bahamas were one of the most beautiful coral reefs on the Earth's surface. Next slide. Here's a close-up view of the coral reefs in the Bahamas, and even closer in the next slide. It doesn't look real, does it? It looks like maybe a watercolor painting you might see in a museum, and that's just how it looks out the window. Next slide. There's an even closer look at the same reef. Next slide. Rivers and river systems, just another unique thing to look at. This river system is in India, the northern part of India. It flows out of the Himalaya Mountains. My research tells me there's lots of tigers and elephants and other wildlife in that river system, so you probably don't want to go walking around there. Next slide. This river system is on the border between China and Russia. It just looked very fascinating to me, so I took a whole bunch of pictures. The reason the picture is jagged like that is because this is multiple shots that are overlapped that I used Photoshop to then merge together to get a bigger panorama. Next slide. This is a river system. It almost looks dry, and it probably is because it's in the center of the continent of Australia. Australia is very unique. You look at it, and it looks like the surface of another planet, at least from space. Very unique in its texture and structure. Next slide. Here's a river on the island of Madagascar off the continent of Africa. Very unique, primarily in its color. It's also beautiful in its pattern. It's got this reddish-orange tint from the clay that washes down from upstream as it flows into the Indian Ocean. Next slide. Niagara Falls, this in the wintertime. If you've been to Niagara Falls, that's another spectacular sight, of course, to see the falls right there in the center of the screen. Next. So that's the globe. This one here is looking down the St. Lawrence Seaway across the continent of North America. When we see these things, as I've mentioned, we see they're beautiful to us, right? And we can see some order in these things. We begin to see some order in the pictures that I've shown. We can see harmony, what we would call harmony in color and pattern. They're pleasing to our sight. Just like good music is pleasing to our ears, some things are pleasing to our eyes, other things are not so pleasing. And these things, I purposely chose them because they demonstrate something that's pleasing to us, that display beauty and splendor. We love to contemplate and ponder these things, especially those of us that believe in the Lord Jesus Christ, and to contemplate His grace in our lives and to begin to contemplate Him as creator of all things and the wonder and the mystery behind that. I would contend that the fact that we contemplate these things, we think about these things, we like to look at them, and how we contemplate them gives testimony to this. That is bearing the image of God, right? So you can, when you see a presentation like this or hear about this or contemplate these things, it also, if we look in the mirror, we can see a little bit of ourselves and we can see what it means to bear God's image. We know that we have a curiosity. We know that we like to search things out. We do space exploration just like we do other exploration because of our inherent curiosity. We want to know why things work. You kids are going to school and you're learning things. Some of it you enjoy, some of it maybe you don't enjoy. But the things that you enjoy, you find curious. You want to understand why it works that way. You want to know things. That's inherent in bearing the image of God. We have a need to know. We have a quest that's typical among us for meaning in life, wondering where we're going, what our destiny is. We know that in Christ, but yet in the circumstances of our individual lives, we still struggle with that in varying degrees. We have a self-awareness. We have a will. We have emotions. We have a moral sense, right? We can all relate to that, a moral sense of right and wrong. All of that gives testimony to bearing the image of God. So that's another theme that I want to encourage you to kind of have in the background as we continue through this. Psalm 111 says, "Great are the works of the Lord. They are studied by all who delight in them." So even the psalmist affirms that we study these things because it is part of our created being, bearing God's image. "Splendid and majestic is his work," the psalmist continues, "and his righteousness endures forever. He has made his wonders to be remembered." Right? So even according to the psalmist, it's proper that we should be here considering these things, the wonders of God's creation. Let's go on to the next slide here. This is a volcano. I'm going to tell a little personal story here. You guys will relate to this. I think most of you probably experienced God's provision in your life, even in the little things. This, by the way, is a volcano that demonstrates the power that's also present in God's creation in a very vivid way. This particular volcano eruption took place in the Aleutian Islands in May of 2006. I was about 6 weeks into a six-month stay in the space station, so there was no end in sight. And although you don't get bored there, I was missing my family, missing my wife, just having one of those down days. And I think you can all relate to that. We have them from time to time. So I went back way in the back end of the space station, and it was just two of us on board, Pavel Vinogradov, my Russian crewmate, and I. And I went back there to have we don't have a cup of tea, but we have a bag of tea. We drink through a straw. Went back to have a bag of tea with Pavel and chat with him a little bit. And got done, and as I was starting to float forward to go back to work, to my assigned work, I passed by a window, looked out the window, and saw what I recognized right away to be the Aleutian Islands. So as was my habit, when I had something out the window to take a picture of, and I had a minute, I grabbed a camera, got in the window, and started taking a picture. First the first island, the next island, and then something in the back of my head said, "Whoa, something didn't look right in that last one." I went back and looked at it, and it was this volcano erupting. So I snapped off two or three pictures before it went out of view, and then got all excited, you know, hollered at Pavel. By the time he got to the window, it was gone. I went up to the forward end of the space station, called Houston, said, "Hey, I just saw this volcano erupting, and I thought you'd like to know. I took some pictures. I'm going to send them down to you, and you can take a look at them." So I was all excited by this because you can see the entire plume in the picture. So the eruption had just started. So as I said earlier, we go around the Earth every 90 minutes. So I was going to be back in that window 90 minutes later to take another picture. And the next slide shows that same volcano. The eruption was done. It was over with. In that 90 minutes, the mission control in Houston had got on the internet, found the Alaskan Volcano Observatory, called them up, said, "Hey, one of our astronauts just reported one of your volcanoes is erupting. We thought you'd like to know." Had that conversation. They have data systems out here to measure seismo activity, but they don't have real-time telemetry, so they didn't know anything about the eruption yet. They thought it was a prank call. Certainly, you know, nobody's up, you know, in space seeing this volcano. But in the meantime, they gave me the name of the scientist and her phone number, so I called her up. And when you get a call from the space station, it doesn't sound right. There's a delay in the transmission. I explained who I was and asked her if she'd gotten the pictures yet. She said no. I said, "Well, I'll send them to you," because we have email capability, although it's not real time. But I sent her a picture. I could tell she thought it was still a prank call, although she had a little bit of doubt. Long story short, in the end, of course, they found out it was all in the up and up, and they had a pretty good time with it. After the flight, I actually contacted the observatory and had a good time talking to the team up there. And then later, of course, they verified the eruption, got the data, and had a lot of fun with that. But the where I'm going with this is my wife knew that I was having a bad day, and she specifically prayed that God would bring something in my day to lift me up out of my slump in a very special way, and he did. So that was a direct answer to her prayer. That's the personal part of it, and it gives testimony to the provision in even simple ways, right, of our gracious God. Let's go on. More example of power and creation, hurricanes, very tragic, and destruction destructive at times from a distance, can be very beautiful and awesome in their own way. This one was in the Atlantic Ocean, never made landfall, so didn't do any damage that I know of. Next slide. Sandstorms here. This is in the country of Kazakhstan. You see a lot of big sandstorms in northern Africa as well. Next slide. This is a fire. A fire typically seen or occurring in California and other places in the West. This is in Southern California. Some of you are familiar with Southern California. That's Edwards Air Force Base in the lower right-hand corner, Rogers Lake Bed there. This was called the Day Fire in September 2006. I took this picture. So just another example of the power that we see in God's creation. Next slide. Sand dunes, another favorite topic for a couple of reasons. One is their beauty, the texture. This is in the Sahara Desert. Next slide. You can see a pattern of dunes. With the dunes, you can see a large scale. Here you see some very large dunes on the left of center there, pointing to the left. Those things are about 1,000 feet tall. This is in the country of Namibia in the southwestern corner of Africa. But you see a pattern. There's a repeated pattern. And then to the right of those, you see other sand dunes in other shapes, and you see a repeated pattern. You can see rows, major rows, and then if you look in each row, you can see in a smaller scale repeated patterns. Next slide. Another example of sand dunes, this is in Mongolia, and those are lakes. They caught my attention. There's the very high water table there, so those are lakes in the middle of the dunes. Again, you see the pattern, both large-scale rows and small-scale in the detail. Next slide. This one is, I love, it's in the Sahara Desert, but it looks geometric, right? There's a crisscross there, and this really shows the pattern, makes it really obvious. And I've got a big math background, and I've always liked, even growing up as a kid, I loved math, because you could predict what you could see around you. Mathematics, like what we're observing here, demonstrates order in God's creation. Mathematics in a very unique way. And if you're not a math person, perhaps you're a music person. Music also demonstrates order in God's creation in the same way that these visual things demonstrate order in God's creation. And it's because of the laws of physics, the laws of nature, and the precise order that we find there that we're able to do all of the things that we typically take for granted. Even stepping on the brake in your car and having it stop in a predictable manner is a result of order in God's creation. Next slide. Another grand view with a low sun angle. Let's go on to the next slide. Here's another example of order in God's creation with this repeated rolls of clouds. But if you look behind there, I want to shift the themes to God's provision in his creation. If you look behind the clouds, you can see faintly some circles and some grid squares. That's agriculture in the Midwest, a couple states west of here, as I recall. So God's creation is not only beautiful and ordered, but it's also functional. It has purpose by design. Isaiah writes in chapter 45, he is the God who formed the earth and made it. He established it, did not create it a waste place, but formed it to be inhabited. Our earth, as we all know, but don't often think about, was purposely designed and positioned for life, and life was purposely designed to fill it. Genesis 1 has that very familiar passage. And God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over every living thing. He gave us a commission, right? And for that purpose, for that commission, he gave us provision in God's creation. Of course, I mentioned earlier, gave us the atmosphere and the water cycle. That's a big part of our life support system. That's what we call, we have to take all our life support system with us to the space station for oxygen, carbon dioxide removal, humidity removal. We have to take water for whatnot. God gave us that in his creation. Next slide, next several slides will demonstrate that. These are grain fields north of Paris. The other thing you can see with agriculture is you see patterns, you see the elements of history, you see where in the world you are, you see soil types, you can see types of agriculture unique to the world. So you begin to learn the surface of the world. Again, this is north of Paris, grain fields. Next slide. This checkerboard pattern is forestry operations in the state of Washington, not too far from Mount St. Helens and Mount Rainier. Next slide. This is in South America, in Bolivia, as I recall, a very unique geometric design of some type of agriculture. It catches your eye for obvious reasons. Next slide. Very unique. This is in central or a little south of central in Africa, of obviously a village structure in the texture. If you could see the fine texture of the agriculture here. But again, getting provision for sustenance out of God's creation. Next slide. Oil wells in New Mexico and agricultural circles that you see around them. Next slide. A minefield. This one is, I believe, in northern Mexico. Next slide. Another minefield. I think this is in Arizona, if I recall correctly. Next slide. Strip mines. These are coal mines in Eastern Europe. Next. Salt ponds in Western China. Do you know that wars have been fought over salt? Salt has always been very critical, primarily for the preservation of food. But before refrigeration, obviously, was very critical. Next slide. This is unique. Fish farms on the Nile River Delta in sun glint. So all the little dividing things from the fish farm show up. Next slide. And speaking of the Nile Delta, that's it right there. It's very difficult to see, but perhaps you can see the Suez Canal to the right side of the dark area there. Of course, the dark area is irrigated, and then you have desert in Egypt of the northern Africa, of course, surrounding it. Back to Job. Job 28 gives testimony to all of this as well, all of this provision that comes out of the earth. In the beginning of Job 28, he says, "Surely there is a mine for silver, a place for gold. Iron is taken out of the earth, copper smelted. Man puts an end to darkness and searches out to the farthest limit, the ore and gloom and deep darkness." What he's talking about here is he's talking about the provision that we find in the earth, and then he's talking about, in parallel with that, man's ability to extract that provision that God had placed there. Not only just extracting it, the raw material out, but then doing something with it. Mankind has the capacity to do things with it, right? And, you know, nowadays we have something like our smartphone that does amazing things that, you know, 15 years ago we wouldn't have dreamed of. That's because of the provision in God's creation and mankind's ability to extract from that provision. He goes on, man opens a shaft in the valley away from where anyone lives. He says, "For as I'm skipping a couple verses here. As for the earth, out of it comes bread, but underneath it is turned up as by fire. Its stones are a place of sapphires, and it has dust of gold. No path, or that path, no bird of prey knows, and the falcon's eye has not seen it. The lion has not passed over it. But man puts his hand to the flinty rock and overturns mountains by the roots. He cuts channels in the rocks. His eye sees every precious thing. He dams up the streams so that they do not trickle." So it's given testimony to the provision in the earth and then mankind's ability to extract from that provision. It gives testimony to the resources, the God-given resources we're given for industry. It explains a lot of history as we study history. Creation is abundant with resources, and man has a God-given ability to tap them. Let's go on and see some examples of that. Here, of course, the previous picture was the whole Nile Delta. Here's a close-up of one part of it, the pyramids right there in the center of the picture. So seen with the naked eye. And, of course, the pyramids we know of very well from studying history, and they go way back in history. Next slide. New York City. That's Manhattan Island. You can see Central Park to the left of center, to the right of center, the very tip of the island. This one was taken after the World Trade Center had been excavated, so that all of the debris had been removed. And you can see kind of a hole there in the middle of the southern end of Manhattan. Next slide. Pearl Harbor. The airfield down there in the lower right part of the screen. the naval fleet in the upper part of the screen there, just left of center. Of course, a lot of history there. And these things are demonstrations of civilization, of course, glimpses of history and different chapters of history that we're familiar with, but also gives demonstration of the industry and commerce of mankind and his ability to pull out of creation the resources necessary to develop them. Next slide. Baghdad. That was the green zone right there in the center on the Tigris River. Of course, all the recent history there as well as ancient history. Next slide. Washington, D.C. Potomac River flowing through there. Below center is the Pentagon. You might be able to make that out. Right in the center of the screen is the mall area. And if, by the way, these pictures can be made available, perhaps. I shouldn't say this because the staff may not like the logistics of distributing them, but they can be made available. And if you get them on your computer, you can see a whole lot more detail on a high-definition screen. But you can make out all of the details of the Washington Mall, the Capitol, the White House, the monuments and all that. Great detail. Next slide. One area that is full of history is the Middle East, of course. And here we see an oblique view of the Nile River and the Delta up in the upper left-hand corner. The Dead Sea right in the center of the screen. You see the Jordan Valley going up to the upper right and the Sea of Galilee. The modern nation of Israel there stands out in contrast to the surrounding countries because of the irrigation that you find in Israel. So it doesn't have quite the desert color that the rest of the countries have. But obviously when you go over this part of the earth and then contemplate not only what we've been talking about with God's creative work and also his provision that he placed in creation, and oh, by the way, sustaining that creation throughout history. But here we have a great opportunity to contemplate his redemptive work and the redemptive story that we find in the Bible. So, and here in one vantage point, you can see essentially the entire life of Christ. Next slide is difficult to see on the screen, but it's a close-up of Jerusalem. Right in the center of the screen, up above center, is the, you might be able to make out a unique structure there. That's the Temple Mount. Geography of Jerusalem, I haven't been there on the ground, but some of you perhaps have, is very hilly, I think, and as evidenced from this photograph. Next slide. The Aegean Sea. So to the right, you can see modern-day Turkey. All of the churches of the Asian churches, of course, that we read about in the New Testament are there. And then we see much of Paul's journeys there with Athens would be left of center in the lower part of the screen, the Church of the Thessalonians in the upper left-hand part. So there's another big portion of the New Testament there seen in this view. Next slide. And then an oblique looking west of Italy. There you can see the boot. So you'll see the horizon of the earth there. See in the very on the other side of the boot, the island of Sicily, and of course another part of the New Testament that you see in this. Let's go to the next slide. Okay, so we're reminded when we see that part of the earth. Of course, we're reminded of many things. Let me just tell you one passage of Scripture to kind of set this everything we've considered in the context of redemptive history. The climax of redemptive history, of course, being the coming of Christ, right? As Paul reminds us in Galatians, when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his Son, born of woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law so that we might receive adoption as sons. Given testimony to the things we've been talking about, not only God as creator who sustains his creation and provides for his creatures, but has redeemed a people of his own through the work of Christ. Going back to Job 28, first part of that chapter, as I said, gives testimony to the provision that God gives in his creation and mankind's God-given ability to extract from that creation. I left off reading in verse 12, verse 11, verse 12 says, but, even given all that, but where shall wisdom be found and where is the place of understanding? That's a huge but. And just picking out a couple of verses in the latter part of that chapter, it says wisdom cannot be bought. It cannot be valued in gold. From where then does wisdom come? Where is the place of understanding? It's hidden from the eyes of all living. It's concealed. We've heard a rumor of it with our ears. God understands the way to it. He knows its place, for he looks to the ends of the earth and sees everything under the heavens. When he gave to the winds its weight, when he gave to the wind its weight and apportioned the waters by the measure, when he made a decree for the rain and a way for lightning and thunder, then he saw it, declared it, he established it, searched it out, and he said to man, behold, the fear of the Lord, that is the beginning of wisdom. To turn away from evil is understanding. Speaking of wisdom here, we know that very familiar verse from Proverbs, the same one, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Let me remind you of a passage from Proverbs that speaks of wisdom, to kind of tie this from Job all the way to Paul in Galatians, to attempt to tie it. Proverbs 8, we know that passage of, or that portion of Proverbs speaks of wisdom. But there's a fascinating part of Proverbs 8, the second half. It's a personification. It's wisdom talking. And the wisdom of God is seen in these verses, where he says, the Lord, wisdom is talking here, the Lord possessed me at the beginning of his work, the first of his acts of old. Ages ago I was set up, at the first, before the beginning of the earth. What's that? Eternity past, right? When there were no depths, I was brought forth. And when there were no springs abounding with water, before the mountains had been shaped, before the hills, I was brought forth. Before he had made the earth with its fields, or the first of the dust of the world, when he established the heavens, I was there. I, wisdom, was there. When he drew a circle on the face of the deep, when he made the skies above, when he established the fountains of the deep, when he assigned to the sea its limits so that the waters might not transgress his command, when he marked out the foundations of the earth, then I was beside him like a master workman. And I was daily his delight, rejoicing before him always, rejoicing in his inhabited world, and delighting in the children of man. Now listen, O sons, listen to me. Blessed are those who keep his ways, hear instruction, and be wise. Do not neglect it. Blessed is the one who listens to me, watching daily at my gates, waiting beside my doors. For whoever finds me, wisdom is still talking, for whoever finds me finds life and obtains favor from the Lord. But he who fails to find me injures himself. All who hate me love death. Wisdom is talking. Who does that sound like? Jesus Christ, right? So now I'll go to Colossians, and this will be the last verse, and then we're going to look at a video here. Colossians chapter 1, verse starting with verse 15. He, that is Jesus Christ, is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. For by him all things were created, in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities. All things were created through him and for him, and he is before all things, and in him all things hold together. He's the creator and the sustainer. And he is the head of the body of the church. He's the beginning, the firstborn from the dead. That is, he is preeminent. He is in everything he might be preeminent, for in him all the fullness of God was pleased to dwell, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether on earth or in heaven, making peace by the blood of his cross. So what I'm attempting to do here is, as we view the world around us, we know the Christian faith and all that, but what I'm attempting to do is tie all of our reality to the wonder of this creator, sustainer, provider, redeemer, God, who has made himself known through the person and work of Jesus Christ. In a very, perhaps a unique way, seen from a unique vantage point, but in a way that I think that each of us can see no matter where we are in each day if we look at the details of life. What questions might you have? We have a few minutes.
Yes.
What lens did I use for the pictures? We have many lenses on board. Most of these pictures were taken with a Kodak Nikon 760, which is an old camera now. Now we have Nikon D3s on board. And we have lenses that range from a fisheye, I think it's a 8mm even, I mean a huge fisheye, all the way up to a 1200mm lens. This is all handheld photography. Many of the pictures probably were taken with an 800mm lens, but there were some other lenses used as well. Yes. How do you sleep up there? That's a good question because it's a weightless, right? So you can't lay on a bed. You can't, you float around. So each of us has what we call a crew quarters, and it's a little room. It's about this big is all. And we each have a sleeping bag, and I tie the sleeping bag to the wall and then climb in the sleeping bag and zip it up, and the sleeping bag keeps me from floating around. You don't need a pillow. Your head just floats. Sometimes you wanna look for the pillow. You bob your head around looking for it, but yeah, it's just floating. It's hard to get used to too. It's even harder to get used to gravity again after you come back though. Yes.
What do you eat?
What do we eat? We have a wide variety of food up there. A lot of the food has been developed by NASA. Some of the food has been developed by the Russians. And we've even had some Japanese and European food up there and a little bit from Canada even as well. A lot of the food is freeze-dried, or not freeze-dried, but dehydrated. So it's dry and it's in bags, plastic bags. And we have a little place where we can inject water into it. So we'll pick out our food for a meal. And we have all the meats, we have vegetables, we have potatoes, we have, you know, all those same things that you eat here. It's just not as good as what mom makes. But you inject water in it, let it sit for usually 10 or 15 minutes. If it's something that you want to have hot, you can stick it in an electric oven to keep it hot or to get it hot. And then you take a pair of scissors after it's rehydrated and cut the package open. As long as things are wet, they stick to the package so they won't float around, and then you just eat it with a spoon. Some of the stuff we have is in cans. We also have the military meals. They're meals ready to eat where you just warm up a package and then cut the package open and eat it. We don't do really well with things like crackers or things that crumb a lot because the crumbs will go everywhere. They're out of control. I tried, somebody sent me up some potato chips. It didn't work very well. Make a mess. Yes?
I was surprised by how bright everything was when you're going over, like, a lot of the U.S. and United Kingdom. Is there a visible difference, like, later in the evening when more people would have gone to sleep? Or is that just that many streetlights and stuff?
And the video at the end there, they probably show up a little bit brighter in the video than they do with the naked eye because those pictures have been enhanced a little bit for the effect on the video. But you still can see, I mean, you make out all the city lights, you make out all those details. That video was run a little bit fast too, so things actually take place much slower than that. But I didn't want to be here for, you know, several hours taking you through several orbits on the video. But you can see all those details. If you turn the lights off on the inside of the space station, you have to turn all the lights off to be able to see the stars with the intensity that you could see in the photography or to see the details on the Earth. But you do see all of those. Does that answer your question?
Well, I just was curious about, like, the time of the evening.
Well, Oh, I see what you're saying. No, I never really sensed, for example, when a city's awake, let's say this time of night and all the lights are on, I never sensed a difference that I could discern between that time of night on a given place of the earth and, say, 3 or 4 in the morning. And if you think about it, most of the lights are from street lights or highways and that kind of thing, and those lights never go out. They're burning all night. Yes. Okay, we'll go where the microphone goes.
How do you walk?
How do we walk?
In space shuttle?
We don't walk. We float. Now you would ask, you know, on Earth we walk by pushing ourselves with our feet and controlling ourselves, stopping ourselves with our feet, maybe jumping, stepping up, stepping down. You can't just float out of control. We have on the walls, we have handrails, things we can grab a hold of. And typically we don't use our feet hardly at all, except to stay in one place. We'll put our toes underneath a rail or something like that, and you'll learn how to control yourself with your toes. But if we're going to go somewhere, I might push off with my feet, but then I use my hands, and I'll go, you know, grab handrails or push myself or change my direction, mostly with my hands. That's on the inside. The outside's kind of the same way. When we go outside, we have to get in a big spacesuit. Spacesuit weighs about 300 pounds if you're on the Earth, but it's weightless up there. But it's still a lot of mass to move around. And when we're on the outside, we go hand over hand, hanging on the handrails. And we have the handrails mounted to the outside of the space station everywhere we need to go out there. And when we do a spacewalk, we go outside for typically 6.5 or more hours. So it's a long day. Okay, where's the microphone? Without the food floating off? Most of the food is a damp, has water in it, like mashed potatoes, right, are damp, they're not dry. If something is damp, it'll stick to the package that it's in. So you still have to be careful with it. You can't, if you move fast or whatnot, move your spoon very fast, it'll fly off. And we're always cleaning up. In fact, we're typically scheduled for every Saturday for cleanup, for housekeeping, just like you do. You have to clean your room once in a while, right? Every Saturday we dedicate to cleaning the space station. And some of the cleaning is just cleaning out the filters that have collected the particulate out of the air. But a lot of the cleaning is spilled food particles and drink particles all over the station. Okay, where'd the mic go now?
I've got the mic. Last question here. Let's go right here.
When you're up in space and with your gravity, is it all mind controlled? If you want, say, down there to be up, you'll suddenly feel upside down?
That's a great question. When in the trainers down in Houston, all of the compartments inside the space station have a logical up and they have a floor. And then when we go in the trainer, we walk on the floor like we typically do and do our training. When we get up there, we float into a module and it looks the same. So we always, in your mind, just like you alluded to, that's the floor and that's the ceiling. And if I go upside down, I feel upside down. And so there's a little bit of a mind trick there. But I found that even after a few days, definitely after a few weeks, there's something switches in your mind where you're no longer limited by that orientation. You can make anything the floor and anything the ceiling. So you learn how to work and adjust your thinking to work in three dimensions in a new way. That's a great question. So thank you very much. We're out of time.